Pleasure chance to grab the conversation with Nicholas Meyer. The view from the bridge, hearing 99 Luftballons again, where the only line in the German version that most people recognize in English is Captain Kirk just pops up. And it's actually one of the few lines in the German version and the English version of that song that have anything to do with each other. The rest of it, it's not even a translation in English. It's like a whole other lyrical song, except for that line about Captain Kirk, which just goes to show you how universal that character is, and what an holy obligation it was to direct a movie like Wrath of Khan or any of the other Star Trek movies. Nicholas Meyer's life is told in The View from the Bridge. We were just talking about Star Trek VI. We never got to The Day After. I hope to get to that. Still, I think the most watched TV movie of all time, maybe of all time ever, in that with all of the media being siphoned off by cable and satellite and DVD, that we may never have another movie with the single night impact that we did with The Day After. We'll talk about that this hour. Get your calls in. If you haven't listened last night, you might enjoy also the Harvard Psychedelic Club. We had on author Don Latton talking about this very formative time in American history where the 50s were killed off essentially with this psychedelic experiments of Harvard with Timothy Leary and Houston Smith and Ram Dass later on. I think you'd really enjoy that if you go back and listen to it in Streamlink. And if you heard me last night, you heard that I had virtually no voice, but I had like 1,000 sucrets since last night, just so I could be ready for Nicholas Meyer coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, we'll get another hour here with Nicholas Meyer in the next hour. What happened to your flying car? Paul Milo knows, and we'll talk about that. The disappointments of the current century, with all the things we were supposed to have by the year 2010. But first, let's go east of the Rockies, where Grayson is in Michigan for Nicholas Meyer on Coast to Coast. Grayson?
Hi, guys. I should preface this by saying that I'm a big fan of the first Star Trek movie, and the ultimate irony is that Robert Wise did a movie about diplomacy, which was, of course, The Sand Pebbles with Steve McQueen. And, Nick, I know you interviewed Wise for the DVD of The Day the Earth Stood Still. And did he have any, did you guys talk about the first Star Trek movie, and did he have any regrets about it?
Okay.
Did he feel it hurt his career?
Grayson, you're breaking up a little bit, so I'm going to put you on hold so you can hear the answer. Go ahead, Nicholas.
My interview with Wise, whom I met on a number of occasions, I thought he was a lovely guy. We never discussed The Sand Pebbles, though certainly watching The Sand Pebbles, which is a movie I enjoy a lot, certainly put me in mind of some of those Star Trek episodes and sort of vice versa. When I interviewed him, it wasn't for the DVD of The Day the Earth Stood Still. It was for the laser disc. And what they,
wow.
What they did was they showed the movie, and they had us in a theater with a microphone between us. And basically my assignment, and I'm trying to think if it was The Day the Earth Stood Still or it was another movie of his, or maybe we did it twice. But I think it was The Day the Earth Stood Still. And we were really talking about echoes of the Cold War as reflected in that movie, the McCarthy era of witch hunting and the sort of whole sort of communist menace and how worked up and paranoid everybody was at the time. And that really formed the sum and substance of our discussion rather than The Sand Pebbles.
Did you ever talk about Star Trek?
I don't think we did, but one thing that I do know is that because everything got so crazy on Star Trek the Motion Picture, Wise always felt that he never got to finish the movie. And some years later, he was given an opportunity to go back into the cutting room. And the general consensus is that the resulting recut of the movie was vastly superior to what was the original release version.
You know, I thought there was an interesting distinction you made right away between Star Trek II and the original Star Trek movie, and that was in the art direction and in the direction of the costumes, as we alluded to earlier. Even that itself, to me, made it a better movie. And there was, you know, I think that your vision for that, it was meaty. It was brawny.
Once you get into the idea of that it's the Navy and not some kind of floating Holiday Inn, the inspiration, if you like, was submarine movies, another Robert Wise movie, Run Silent, Run Deep.
Right.
The Enemy Below, or Life on a Destroyer on a Tin Can. Those things aren't built for comfort, and they're confined, they're claustrophobic. And I had a conversation once with Gene Hackman, who said to me that he thought the best acting took place in very confined, this is talking about movie acting, in confined, closed spaces. And I said, what about Peter O'Toole and Omar Sharif and Lawrence of Arabia? And he goes, well, there's exceptions.
I thought your recollections about working with Gene Hackman were very interesting too, and I appreciated your candor on that. And even in the part of Star Trek II where you're having what you refer to as the submarine battle, I hadn't really thought of it that way. I thought of it as like, you know, two ships and fog, but it was actually more interesting the way you talk about it as kind of submarine warfare.
Well, to me, as I say, whether it was a submarine or whether they were destroyers, the idea to me was the same, A, that it was essentially nautical in character, and B, that the interiors were claustrophobic. So I made the corridors smaller. I tried to make everything smaller. And if I could have, I would have made the bridge completely different.
But no money for that. West of the Rockies, Terry is in Lake Tahoe for Nicholas Meyer, author of The View from the Bridge. Terry?
Hey, Ian, Mr. Meyer. I was wondering, in Wrath of Khan, don't you think Khan would have been regenerated when the Genesis Project went off, just like Spock came back to life?
Your guess is as good as mine. It sounds like a sweet idea to me.
But a great way to get another sequel out of it. Surprisingly, they didn't go that way. It was such a great performance. Douglas is in Minnesota, first-time caller line on Coast to Coast. Douglas?
Hey, great. I'm proud to be on the show. Say, you know, it's funny that Nicholas said that he did it with, sort of emulated The Enemy Below, because that was my dad's favorite movie, and me and my brother just noted that immediately.
Well, you're watching Wrath of Khan?
Yeah. And that, but my question was, whenever I watch Wrath of Khan, we get into the science lab, and we see this huge monitor, this 3-foot-thick monitor, and it always makes me chuckle. What's the story behind that?
I'm not sure that I know exactly what you're referring to.
The Carol Marcus,
Oh, she's like watching a TV set?
Yeah, it's huge. It's an old-fashioned, you know, 3-foot-deep monitor. It's like, you know, in the 21st century.
Well, actually, I think it's supposed to, isn't it supposed to be the 23rd century?
Okay, right. 23rd.
Yeah,
but
that's
saying,
when they went back to the big monitors.
Oh, okay.
They enjoyed there was a certain nostalgia for the old big monitors in the 23rd century.
Who directed The Enemy Below? Here's a trick question.
I don't know. Robert Wise? No?
No. You'll never guess in a million years, which is why it's a good question. It was directed by Dick Powell.
Oh, really?
Yep.
The actor?
The actor.
Huh.
The guy from the Busby Berkeley movies with the high tenor voice who later turned out to be a great Philip Marlowe when he lowered his voice.
Right. Oh, interesting. Why? Did he end up directing that?
He became a director, and he was a very good one.
So that wasn't his first movie, or he didn't happen upon it?
I don't think it was his first. I'm not sure.
Bill, Wildcard Line, Costa Mesa, California, for Nicholas Meyer, author of The View from the Bridge. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. Bill?
Yeah, hi, Nicholas. There's a piece of dialogue in Wrath of Khan I've never quite understood from Ricardo Montalban. It's the early part of the film where Chekhov and I think Paul Winfield, they're exploring Khan's living quarters. And Khan comes in and, like, interrupts them, and they're trying to get out. And I think Khan, at one point, he says to Paul Winfield, I don't recognize you. And then he turns to Chekhov, but you, I recognize.
Right.
And I'm going, in the original Star Trek TV episode Space Seed, Chekhov wasn't in it. So how could he recognize him?
He's all over this one, Bill. Go ahead, Nicholas.
Well, I've always maintained that the Enterprise, being a very large ship, Chekhov was definitely on board. He just wasn't in any scenes in the episode that were depicted. As I say in my memoir, because I've been accused of fluffing the Chekhov business before, I've had the privilege or the good fortune of sailing back and forth across the Atlantic when I was a kid on ocean liners on the Queen Mary. And the Queen Mary held 3,500 people, 3,000 passengers and 500 crew. So I could well imagine that the Enterprise, probably an even larger craft in space, could hold many, many people, and I just assumed that Chekhov got kind of lost in the shuffle.
I think that he just hadn't been promoted yet. Makes perfect sense. Why not?
It's the best I can come up with.
I think it's great.
It's a testament to my ignorance of Star Trek when I came on the movie.
It's a backstory that Chekhov deserves. And at one point, he was below deck working his way up to the top. And
he was a swabby, yeah.
That's where Khan saw him, and he remembers everything because he's Khan. Paul is in Ontario, California, on Coast to Coast on a wild card line for Nicholas Meyer. Paul?
Hi, Nicholas Meyer.
Hi.
Fun to be on tonight. Thank you for putting me on here. About an hour ago, there was a weird flash of light over Ontario. I don't want to get into that right now. My question for Nicholas Meyer is, what is your take on a homemade Star Trek fan film, such as like Star Trek Phase 2, if you have seen any of them? And even if you could put James Colley of Star Trek Phase 2 on your show.
I like that, but that's a very interesting question. Have you seen any of the fan films of Star Trek?
My favorite one is the opera of The Wrath of Khan, which is all in Italian with claymation puppets and a pretty good musical score. And I decided that was a keeper. And I've also seen some Shakespeare performed in Klingon, and decided that that was pretty cool as well. I don't know how many there are out there, but those are the ones I've seen.
Of all the many things that you've written, have you ever written a libretto for an opera?
Well, funnily enough, Cliff Eidelman, who wrote the score for Star Trek VI, and I have been trying to interest anybody we can, I mean, Paramount, really, in the idea of an opera based on Star Trek VI. And we were, you know, sort of trying to hammer out at least the outline of a libretto. I don't know that anything will ever come of it, but...
Well, I don't know if this will help you or not, but of my give-back jobs during the week, one of those is a pro bono post with the Minnesota Opera Company. I could get you a meeting.
The idea is extremely tempting. The first thing I've got to do is to get some kind of legal go-ahead from Paramount, or I think actually CBS, which controls the Star Trek material. If I can do that, I'll take you up on your offer.
Well, I know a guy that does that for he does all of the rights and clearances for the Minnesota Opera Company, which is a very well-known experimental opera group. They do several classics every year, but also go way out where no opera company has gone before, time and time again. I could hook you up with a guy who would do the clearances for you.
That sounds very promising to me.
If you're interested, I can give you my email. You let me know. I think
sure.
I would really love that. Vincent is in Granbury, Texas, on Coast to Coast on a wild card line for Nicholas Meyer. Vincent?
Good morning, gentlemen. Ian, you are the best coast-to-coast host ever.
Well, we know that's not true, but thank you, Vincent, for those kind words. We absolutely know that there's no way I'll compare myself to any of the majors, but it's nice to be included. Question for Nicholas Meyer.
Yes, sir. Mr. Meyer, I know that you were kind of late come to the franchise, but I'm wondering, what are your opinions of the other TV shows, Next Generation, Voyager, and
Deep Space Nine.
And right. Also, Big Mac and fries.
Where are you with that? The idea of did your love for Star Trek go be sort of retroactively then, as you worked through Star Trek, did you become sort of a fan of the later series?
Well, what happened was that, in a funny way, I became a fan of the earlier series, which is to say that, you know, when you're on the road and sitting in some hotel room and you turn on the TV and there is Kirk and Spock and McCoy, whereas I formerly didn't pay any attention to those people in that program, I now would sort of sit and feel like I was sort of visiting with friends, and it made me feel good. It made me feel less lonely, and I was sort of watching and sort of becoming more knowledgeable about it. And then I became interested, not in any systematic way. I can't say that I sat down and watched it systematically. I don't watch a lot of episodic television in anything that could be called a systematic fashion. I think, with few exceptions, I think I like to watch Mad Men and stuff like that. But when I would see these Star Trek spin-offs, I would sort of watch because I was curious about the evolution in sort of special effects and production values, and saying, oh gosh, I wish we'd had that or been able to do this. And generally also to keep track of, you know, how much of my innovations got carried over. Yeah. You know, oh, look, they're still wearing essentially the same uniforms, right, and so forth.
You, there is a Nicholas Meyer effect on the subsequent TV products.
Well, I like to think so anyway. I'm vain enough to think so.
No, there is. And I think it speaks to both the success of Wrath of Khan and the ensuing movies. But, you know, you had your stamp on the movies continued, whether you were, you know, writing or participating in the writing of Star Trek IV or directing Star Trek VI, still your fingerprints were on that series, which helped it. I mean, it was only in a positive way, which is good. All right, so Herb from your old haunts in Iowa coming up in just a second. Also, we'll get to calls from all over the country for Nicholas Meyer, and I want to save a minute or two for the day after. Nicholas has kindly agreed to revisit a visit sometime in the future with us from both the book, The View from the Bridge, and his memories of Star Trek and a life in Hollywood. You can find out more by going online, hooking up to him, get the book. It's brand new. It's excellent. And it really fills in the gaps for not just fans, but also for people interested in autobiography. It tells a great story of a creative life. And you can find out more at coasttocoastam.com. This is Ian Punnett. Got to get a couple minutes here, too, on Nicholas Meyer's reflections on Shatner, too, coming up in just a minute. It's in the book, The View from the Bridge, and actually his thoughts kind of surprised me. So I look forward to visiting that with you coming up in just a second. Also, funny, I'm hearing from all of my comic book friends, David Mack of Daredevil and Kabuki, emailing in, listening to Nicholas Meyer tonight, and my friend Terrence Greep of Scooby-Doo comic book fame, also registering his approval of this show. So let's get back to it right away so that we get more calls in with you and Nicholas Meyer next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. What happened to your flying car? We'll find out after the top of the hour. But first, another half hour to go with Nicholas Meyer. More memories of Star Trek and a life in Hollywood. We pick it up with Patrick in Portland on Coast to Coast, west of the Rockies. Patrick?
Yeah, Ian and Nicholas, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. Quick comment then a quick question. The comment, my observation with Star Trek II is it almost made the subsequent films with the original cast possible after Star Trek I.
No doubt.
Yeah, because the reason that I see is that it returned back to the original feel of the original series. Yeah, it was really absent in the first movie.
Well, that's as much an accident as anything, since I really didn't know what the series consisted of, except in a rather cursory or superficial way. The fact that it did justice or echoed or reverberated with tones of the original is all to the good, but essentially entirely fortuitous. What is certainly true is that there would not have been a 3 had not 2 been a success. They were...
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, with the drawing of the storyline, sure. One question for you. Have you ever heard a comment, I know you're not responsible for Star Trek 7, but have you ever heard a comment that there wasn't almost a deliberate effort to put the original franchise, the original crew to sleep, if you will, with the way they killed off Kirk in that film? It was rather non-dramatic and kind of haphazard the way that occurred.
I hadn't heard that. What I have heard is that the people who made X-Men were very, very influenced by The Wrath of Khan. I mean, I've heard it from those people. I've heard it from Brian Singer. I heard it from Alex Young, who was at Fox, which was what they wanted, was they wanted to make their own Wrath of Khan movie. I never really followed what happened to the rest of the Star Trek movies very closely after that. I'm just insecure enough that I always worried that if I saw one of those other movies that I would like it better than any of mine, and that for a very long time sort of kept me away from it. And finally, about a year or two ago, I agreed to do a segment for one of the DVDs on the villains of Star Trek. And in order to do that, I did have to sit down and watch all the other Trek movies and finally decide, you know, who is the greatest villain of all. And I came to the conclusion that Star Trek IV has the greatest villain, who is never seen and never mentioned by name.
And I know where you're going with that. That, I mean, are you talking about the space probe, or are you talking about pollution of the Earth?
I'm talking about man.
Yeah. Okay. It's pollution of the Earth, then.
Pollution and the destruction.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. You have everything to be proud of. The story is always told by Trek fans that 2, 4, and 6, the even-numbered Star Trek movies, are the best. And of the odd-numbered ones, I think 3 is the best one. But he said something, Patrick mentioned the word haphazard, and I think haphazard, after reading the book, The View from the Bridge, is the, if there's a theme to how these Star Trek movies existed in one form at one time, it was haphazard. It was sort of always bringing order to chaos, is what it seemed like you were doing.
Well, for the studios, Star Trek turned out to be a lucrative business. The word franchise is something I never used, I don't believe, in my memoir, and it never occurred to me. I was just doing one job at a time, and I didn't have any sort of big picture or sort of long-term financial thoughts. But for the studio, are they passionately involved with the material? I don't necessarily think they are. But what they are passionately involved with, which is their business, is making money, is trying to figure out what makes money. And so their Star Trek decisions are essentially monetary decisions, whether there will or will not be another one, whether it will or will not be with the original cast, how much money will or won't be spent on it. These are bean counter questions, and it's not a question of tremendous personal connection. It is also true, by the way, that certain individual executives over the course of the series and the seasons do in fact enjoy them greatly, but they are haphazard in the way that the timing occurs now, today, yes, no, we're short of product, this one didn't do well. So
here's four scripts. I mean, here's a non-script to make a movie of that in 12 days. I mean, there's a haphazard, I think, is an interesting theme for that. Let's get Herb in Iowa, east of the Rockies, for Nicholas Meyer on Coast to Coast. Herb?
How you doing?
Okay.
I'm in Riverside, Iowa, known as the future birthplace of Captain Kirk.
Yes.
Are you familiar with that?
I certainly am.
Okay. Do you remember back in 2004 when Shatner had filmed Invasion of Iowa?
Yep.
And I remember you had some comments about him. You sounded like you weren't too happy with him doing that. I think maybe you were kind of worried about the town being hurt by it or something like that.
Well, as I recollect, what happened was that he sort of played a practical joke and said they were there to cast a movie and got everybody all worked up, and it turned out that was not true. Isn't that, in a sense, what happened?
Is that what happened, Herb, roughly?
Yeah, I mean, it all turned out positive. There were, people on the Riverside themselves that were upset about it, but after it was all said and done, and he had presented the town with a check for $100,000.
Oh, well.
And then he gave the main stars in the show certain gifts, like sending, Scotty was one of the people, and they're just sent to Hawaii, stuff like that. I mean, all turned out positive.
Well, I'm glad it turned out positive at the time, and I certainly didn't know anything about $100,000, money of absolves a lot of things, or at least that's the popular response to it. I thought he was sort of making fun of those people and having fun at their expense, and I wasn't amused. I didn't think it was his finest hour, but maybe the fact that everybody got a lot of money out of it and it ended well, as you suggest, means that I didn't know what I was talking about, which wouldn't be the first time.
You like him, though, and you had very flattering words about
I do
about
like
William
Bill. Yes,
Shatner.
I do.
In the book, and I was sort of intrigued by your take on him, which is that, unlike perhaps how he's perceived publicly in some respects, he's not arrogant, and he's not the kind of actor that sometimes people speak of him as being.
Well, I think when I worked with him, when I knew him, he was very, very protective of the character of James Kirk. It was his. He was the personification. He was the interpreter. He was, actors often say, well, I created the role, which doesn't say much for the writer, I suppose. But in some sense, they do create the role. They bring it to life. They bring it off the page. And Bill did that with Kirk, and he was very protective about it. What I said about him was that, some people think that he was very egotistical, and I don't think that's what I got from him. He was very vain. I thought he was pretty vain. But I don't think being vain and being egotistical are quite the same things. I thought when he wasn't, on the set, when he wasn't being Captain Kirk, he was a thoughtful person, read books, was very interested in horseback riding, and had a whole bunch of... he was the kind of person who listened when other people spoke and was sort of interested in what they had to say, and not sort of needing to be the center of attention, except when he was sort of, doing his job, being on stage, which is, after all, what they're for, what their work is.
The work, the work that you did in The Day After, and I'm afraid we just won't. There's so many people that want to ask questions of you, and I don't want to take that opportunity away from them. But
okay.
I would look forward someday to being able to do that part of your book, The View from the Bridge, and talk about that, because it was such an important piece and remains the most watched TV movie of all time, and it had too a very interesting sort of history. And your involvement and the way in which you fought for it, and in the end, the final product and the impact that it had, not just in the entertainment industry, but also how it changed politics. And
the movie that changed Ronald Reagan's mind about a winnable nuclear war.
It did. And so that is something that I look forward to getting back to. But in the meantime, Scott is in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on Coast to Coast for Nicholas Meyer.
Wow, this is definitely an honor, Mr. Meyer. I've admired your work for years.
You are very kind.
As Ian said, the Time After Time is one of my all-time favorite movies.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to find it to keep it because I have kids. And I want to show them this is how good movies are made, guys. I just want to make a real quick comment and then a question. Ian, please never, never, never play Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds by William Shatner again. My ears still hurt.
Come on, dude, that's the best.
I know, it's cruel, but what can I tell you? Mr. Meyer, you know, you talk about your influence on the shows and everything like that. Well, you know, the Next Generation, they had the uniforms reflected the uniforms that you designed from the second movie. My question, though, is, and how did you pick James Horner for the music? Because I collect movie soundtracks, and that's what I listen to.
Me too.
And that I keep that in my car, and when I want to get pumped up, I'm a cop, so I work a lot of nights. So when I want to get pumped up, I play that music. And I'm just curious where you came up with him, because it was a perfect choice.
Well, thank you. I'm glad it turned out to be a perfect choice. Basically, when we were doing Star Trek II, we didn't have a lot of money. So there was no way, for example, that I could have afforded to hire Jerry Goldsmith, who certainly one of the best in the business and had done the music for Star Trek, the motion picture. We just didn't have that money. So, again, this was going to be a case of art thriving on restrictions, and I was going to have to, you know, listen to a lot of demo tapes, which is what I did. And in those days, that's what they were. They were cassette tapes. And listened and listened and listened. And I'm afraid a lot of them sounded all kind of cut from the same cookie cutter, the way, you know, cars used to look really, really different. And then there came a point where they all started to look the same. And I think the same thing happened to a lot of film music. And then I heard a tape that caught my interest, and I, you know, turned it over to see who wrote it. And it was this young James Horner fellow. And so I asked to meet him, and we got along extremely well. And I said, listen, here's a movie which is trying to echo Matters Nautical. You know Debussy, you know Debussy's composition, La Mer, the ocean. Can you do something like that? And it was imprecise, but it was precise enough that he said, oh, sure, I know La Mer. And that was his sort of point of taking off. And some weeks later, he came to my house and sat at my piano and played some of the themes. And at that point, you say, well, this sounds pretty good. And there is a point where you make a movie, and it's usually called the spotting session, where you and the composer and one or two other people sit in the movie, and you watch it, and you talk about where the music ought to go in, where the music ought to go out. What is it you want the music to do in a movie anyway? Do you want it to reinforce what's there? Do you want it to contradict what's there? The actor says, I hate you, but the violins are saying, no, he's lying. Do you want the music to supply something that is missing in the movie? Or do you want, in addition to all that, the music to be the voice of the movie, something that even if you heard the music, you know, in an elevator would bring you back in an instant to the movie. And that's what I really wanted, was something that was unique, unique and nautical. And that's sort of what he gave me.
There's more on that in the book, The View from the Bridge. We probably have time for one last question before the top of the hour. And then Robert in Los Angeles, you get it. And I'm sorry to everybody else that's been waiting as long as they have to talk with
me too.
Nicholas Meyer. Robert?
Yes, hi. Good morning, guys. I have a question. I've always been curious as to why, you know, in Star Trek One, when Decker and Leah combined with V'ger and they took off someplace, you know, why it was never brought up again, you know, another movie or mentioned any of the other movies.
That's a good question. I mean, that isn't entirely a Nicholas Meyer question, but other writers,
well,
nobody else.
Might be a new movie for him.
Yeah, well, nobody else ever really pursued it. Nicholas?
I cannot speak intelligently to this. I mean, there were some people who will say I cannot speak intelligently at all, but I don't know.
Well, they haven't read your book, The View from the Bridge, Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood. You know, I've often, I think something like opera is such great art because it's sort of like a giant mural painting that's based on a haiku. I mean, there's just something, the words are minimal, but the images are huge from that. And I think that's what I like about so much of your work. And it was interesting to read about that as you wrote about trying to get as many words off the page and trying to get as much of that done with the image. So I will look forward to still seeing what you come up with in life. What else is it that you're working on these days? What would be next for you?
Well, I just finished writing a movie for Johnny Depp that I've been trying to get going for 10 years. And of course, the moment he heard it, he understood what no executive could understand. And he said, wow, this sounds terrific. And so I got hired to write that script, and I hope he finds time to make it. I understand he's very pleased with the result, which he should be. And it's called The Crook Factory. I've also been writing a movie about George Washington, who's sort of my personal hero. And I always wanted to write a movie about Washington because I don't think many people quite understand who or what he was. And I wrote The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping one day somebody will get around to making that. It's hard to make movies that are movies about people. What somebody said, oh, that's drama. Drama, we don't do drama. We do cartoons. We do exploding cars. We do animation. We do comic books. But if it's about people, it's an uphill slog. I'm not exactly sure why.
Well, I recommend that people go to the IMDb and look at the many films of Nicholas Meyer. I think you'll enjoy each of them for different reasons. Never got around to talking about The Deceivers. Look forward to getting back to that discussion sometime. I saw it recently ranked as in the top 10 English-speaking Bollywood movies of all time. I thought that was interesting.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Yeah. So thank you. I'll just say for now, and when we get a chance to talk again, I would look forward to that. In
whatever
the meantime,
you like.
Thank you for being so generous. God bless you and have a great night. It's Nicholas Meyer, View from the Bridge. Share this stream link with a friend so they can go back and hear it from the beginning. What happened to your flying car? We'll find out next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.